The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Amen. Man, I hope we leave today knowing that we are loved by Him. Loved by Him. Exodus chapter 1, if you have a Bible, would love for you to join me there. Jared last week helped situate this story, this letter for us. We did not have the opportunity, one, to be here, or two, to listen to that. I'd encourage you to go back and do so. I'm going to do a little bit of prep work to still get us into Exodus 1, because it is a continuation story, but there's no way I'll be able to cover all the details that he mentioned last week. We begin officially this morning an 8.5-month journey through the book of Exodus. We'll take a break in the summer to continue our 15-year journey in the summer Psalms. Some of you get that. Excited about that continuation. I'll be in Psalm 23 this year, which has been really near and dear to my heart this past year. But 8.5 months here, Exodus. And maybe you're thinking, but why? Why? Why in the world would we read and study the book of Exodus? And there's a lot of really good answers to that question. An obvious one is, well, it's in the Bible. So we should just read and study the Bible. And that's a great answer. And I could just say that, should just say that and move on, but I'm not going to. I want to be a little bit more specific, because I think there's two reasons I want to point out from the outset of this morning that I think bleed, two significant ideas that bleed all over the pages of these 40 chapters that we're going to be looking at closely this year. And here's the first reason. This is a story about God. The book of Exodus is an identity story, namely about God Himself. We will learn of His name in this story. We will learn of His nature and His character. We will learn of His holiness. We will learn of His presence even when He appears to be absent. We're going to learn of His redemptive purposes, and we're going to learn a lot about His power and His glory. And we're going to learn specifically that He is a God who rescues, who restores, and who reorients the lives of His people to walk in His good purposes. He doesn't just rescue. He rescues, He restores, and He reorients life. You see, Exodus gives us a view of God that transcends every question, every doubt, every longing, every ache, every fear that you and I have. Exodus is a book about God. And we, as His people of utmost importance, you know what we need? A right understanding of who He is. Number two, this is a story that mirrors our story. Our story. So this is a story about God, but this is also our story. It doesn't simply tell Israel's story. Now, I want to be clear. We're going to be patient and methodical and honest with Israel's story. We're not just going to run past that. But this story also tells ours. We need a rescuer. We need a restorer. And we need someone to reorient life, our life, from the inside out, so we can walk in His good purposes. I love the way the theologian Christopher Wright puts it. Listen to this. The unmissable proclamation heard in the openings of all four Gospels is simply this: God is doing it again. The God of Abraham is keeping his promise. The God of Moses is confronting the world's pharaohs. The God of the Exodus is on the way to save his people. Except the confrontation and victory will not come about by God sending plagues upon the Romans, but by God the Son becoming the Passover lamb. His flesh broken, his blood shed on the cross for the redemption not only of Israel, but of people from all nations who put their trust in him. Isn't that great? The Exodus story, I submit to you, is monumental to understanding what God is up to in your life today through the person of Jesus Christ. You see, the beauty of the biblical story, not just Exodus, but the biblical story, is that we are invited by God to live into a better story. His story. And if I were to sum up the singular invitation of God that we find throughout the pages of the Bible, it would be this: God himself is inviting us, you, me, to throw our little story into his greater story. God is inviting us through the person of Jesus Christ. He is saying to us, link up to my story. Join your story to my story and live. That's the invitation of the Bible, of the story of Exodus. Now, with those two thoughts in mind, let's jump into Exodus 1 this morning. And here's what I want to do. I have been tasked to teach this whole chapter. Take a deep breath. I want to pull on two threads in Exodus 1. I'm going to go ahead and give them to you because I want you to hang on to these two threads in the opening chapter of Exodus 1. And then we're going to read a little bit and talk a little bit about it, and I'm going to pull on that thread, and I want you to see it. I think it's profound. Here's the first. The Creator God is the author of the story. Our story. But he writes differently than we do. Let me say that one more time. The Creator God is the author of story, your story, my story, our story. He doesn't write like you and I do. Number two, when the Creator God appears to be absent, we get a glimpse of his nearness through the ordinary faithfulness of his people. I'll say that one more time. When the Creator God appears to be absent, we get a glimpse of his proximity, his nearness, through the ordinary faithfulness of his people. You ready? Verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 people. 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then he died. And all of his brothers and all that generation, but the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. What an invigorating introduction, right? Catch that phrase in verse 1 with me for a moment. Pay attention to it. These are the names of the sons of Israel. Now, I want to draw this out for a moment because this name is tied to not just the people of Israel. It is tied to something significant that God has already spoken. He's already written. Jacob is Abraham's grandson. And in Genesis 35, God does something to Jacob. He changes his name to what? To Israel. Listen to these words. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padam Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel, and God said to him, this is what God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from your own body." Let me key you in on something. God is telling Jacob, "Hey, Jacob, I know what your legal name is. I know what your government name is, but I'm giving you a new name. And your new name is going to be Israel, and I'm attaching to that name my covenant promise. You will be fruitful, and you will multiply." So by the time we come to Exodus chapter 1, what is happening to the people of God? Well, when they arrive in Egypt, there's only 70. Now, something to keep in mind. Most scholars tell us that this singular chapter, Exodus 1, covers the span of about a couple centuries. This isn't like a day or two or a few weeks or even a few years, a couple centuries. We arrive in Exodus 1, and you're telling me they have multiplied greatly to 70 people? But look at verse 7. Notice the language here. They were fruitful. They increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. When we get to Exodus 12, you know what it's going to tell us? There's 600,000 men. Not women, not children. When we get to the section of where they're walking out of Egypt, scholars estimate that they're somewhere around, conservative number, 2.4 million people. The people of Israel are fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and the land was filled with them. What's the point of all of this? Well, first of all, this is Genesis 1 language. You remember Genesis 1? God blessed man and woman, and he said to them, what did he say to them? Be fruitful and multiply. And what? Fill the earth. Now, I want you to see something about this boring introduction. The Creator God, the author of it all, he's weaving his story with precision and great purpose. Hey, you are my people. I've given you a new name, and attached to your name is my covenant promise. Here's the promise. You will be fruitful. And you know what? They were. But do you know how long the people of God waited on this promise to be fulfilled? 430 years. The opening verses of this chapter is keying us in on the fact that God is indeed at work among his people, that he is making good on his promises. But, here's what we have to pay attention to. He often does that work and brings about his promises in ways that we would not do it. He writes differently than us, but he is writing. Verse 8. "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. didn't pay attention to Joseph or the promises given to this new covenant people. And this is what he said to his people. Behold, the people of Israel are too many. So you can see the progression, the implications of God making good on his covenant promises. They're becoming too many, too great, too powerful, too mighty for us. Verse 10, come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if a war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Now, there's a question here. There's a question here that I think we've got to process. Why are they in Egypt? Anybody thinking that? Why are the people of God in Egypt? Well, I'm going to rewind the story. Remember who the author is, right? Let me rewind the story, and I want to remind you of something. God tells Abraham, Genesis chapter 15. Listen to these words. And as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great blessings, great possessions. So here's the author's declaration. In the opening part of that chapter, he brings Abram out of his tent and says, look up at the stars, Abram. Can you count them? I'm going to bless you with a nation, a people, far beyond what you can count. And then a deep sleep falls upon him, or he falls into a deep sleep, and now God tells him, but your people, before they enter into the promised land, will be led into the land of sojourning. And he tells them how long. What I want you to see is they don't arrive in Egypt by chance. They don't arrive in Egypt by ill fate. They don't arrive in Egypt by scheme. No, the author of the story declares this. I'm going to lead them there. I'm not going to leave them there, but I'm going to lead them there. Now, do you understand why that question's important? Why? Why, God, would you do that? Life in the wilderness, wandering, oppression, pain, loss, year after year after year after year. God, where are you and what are you doing? I wonder, have you ever asked that question? God, why did you give me something that looked like blessing, and the moment that I received blessing, it turned into what appears as suffering? Why am I having to deal with this in my marriage? Why this in my parenting? Why this? God, why? I know we've all asked that question, wrestled with that question. The answer will not be given to us explicitly in chapter 1. But as we journey through these 40 chapters, God is slowly and methodically and patiently going to answer that question. And so I want to, for a brief moment before we move to this last section, I want to key you in on where he's going to take us. God is fiercely committed to his glory and our good. Let me say it again. He is fiercely committed to his glory and our good. And sometimes good, it means surgery. Sometimes good means being wounded. Sometimes good means suffering. Now, is that cruel? Is it cruel that God would sovereignly place his people in a contested space under the hand of a wicked ruler to strip away the idols of their heart and the fears that cripple them, so that as he walks with them in the wilderness and they come out on the other side, those idols and those fears no longer control them? Is that cruelty or is that kindness? Is it kind of God that his fierce commitment to his glory being revealed throughout all the earth means that our little stories are being sovereignly woven through joy and sorrow, through blessing and pain, so he might detach from our hands the things of this world and then give to us our greatest need, which is himself? Is that kind of him? Is it kind of God that he would allow us to walk through fiery trials so that as we do, as we trust, as we worship, a watching world gets to look in and behold something of his worth and glory? I want to rewind the story just one more time. Because when we rewind the story, just really one chapter, the people of God have something to say to this question. Do you remember what Joseph said about his story? Do you remember what Joseph said about the favoritism of his father that he never asked for? Do you remember what Joseph said about his brothers betraying him and ultimately seeking to take his life? This is what he said. This is a coffee mug verse. What you meant for evil against me, what you meant for evil over my life, God intended for my good. Brothers and sisters, that is the paradigm of the story of Exodus. God took the sinful choices of his brothers and the hardship that brought upon Joseph's life, and he brought about something good. And that good was the transformation of Joseph's heart and the glory of God being put on display through Joseph's life for the sake of many. And on top of all of that, Joseph is the one who says it was all good. Do you see? God writes differently than we do. Look at it in chapter 1. The people of God in chapter 1 are going to answer this question. They're led to live life in a contested space. How long? 400 years. They're led there. They're led to live under the rule of a wicked king. They're led to live into slavery and hardship. Verse 11 gives us an indication of that. They set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. Those are two names of pagan gods in Egypt. And now this wicked king is putting upon the people of God who worship the one true God every single day the heavy burden of building cities to an idol that is against their God. It's evil, it's wicked, it's treacherous. But look at verse 12. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. And the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread because of the people of Israel. Do you see it? The more they are oppressed, the more they multiply. That they're not living defeated. They're choosing to act in faith on the covenant promise that God attached to their name. And so when God appears to be absent in their hardship, they believe in faith that he is near by choosing to live under the covering of his blessing, even in the face of their suffering. Let me say it again. God doesn't write like us. But if you know the author of the story, you can trust him even when you can't make sense of him. You can trust him even when life hurts. I love the way one writer puts it. He says, the desperate, finding themselves in some wasteland of life, do not have the luxury of indifference. They stir themselves to seek God. They become part of that great fellowship of the poor in spirit, who know not just in theory, but in blood earnest reality, that God is near to the brokenhearted, that he hears the cries of the afflicted, and that compared to a godless promised land, listen to this last line, that compared to a godless promised land, a God-filled wilderness is heaven. The Creator God is the author of the story. Your story. But it's real important to understand he writes differently than you do. Let's keep reading, verse 15. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous and, and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt with the midwives. And the people multiplied. Notice that language again. Multiplied. And they grew even stronger. And because the midwives feared God. Do you see how specific and detailed God is? He gave them families. And Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. This is the only time God is named in the opening chapter of Exodus. On the surface, he appears to be distant, right? Appears to be distant or maybe even absent. And I think you feel that as you read through these 22 verses. This wicked king does the unthinkable. He puts a plan in place to take the innocent life of all male infants. What? What a wicked reality. This is evil personified. But in the midst of that, in the midst of this private, secretive plan to eradicate all the men of Israel, and then this public decree, I want you to pay attention to what's actually going on in the midst of darkness. Look back at verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them. This is, like, that's bold, right? It's bold, it's compelling, especially if we look closely. Did you notice something about the king when we are first introduced to him in verse 8? Did you notice something? He's not named. I find that to be intriguing because this is the most powerful individual living at this time. I can assure you, everyone in Egypt and surrounding Egypt knows his name. They know his character, they know his work, but you and I, we do not know his name. We know this about the king. The unnamed king is afraid. He's afraid that if the people of Israel grow in number, that they will rise up against him and his kingdom. So he devises a plan that cannot fail. Cannot fail. I'm going to eliminate all the men. The people of God will have no ability to reproduce. And there's no need to worry about the women. But verse 15 names two unlikely women, Shiphrah and Puah. We don't know the name of the most powerful person in Egypt, but we do know the names of two ordinary servants, midwives. Historians tell us that these are women that were typically infertile, not having children of their own. Even worse, culturally, they were viewed as useless and sometimes even viewed as cursed. It's likely that these women in particular would have been viewed as the lowest class of people who were enslaved in Egypt. And yet the author tells us their name. That in the face of evil, in the midst of darkness, two unlikely women are quietly but confidently resisting and defying evil and brokenness. Quietly and confidently believing and trusting in the one who's writing their story. Unnamed king puts a plan in place that cannot fail, right? Right? And yet underneath the veil of the darkness is the sovereign hand of God weaving through sorrow and brokenness his good plan. He uses two unlikely women to disrupt the plan of a wicked king. And we know that because of they feared him. They feared God. How did they do that? How did they stare evil in the face and still choose to believe and live in light of the promise? The fear of the Lord. Listen to the psalmist in Psalm 25 talk about this. I love this verse. The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant. You see, fear of the Lord is tied to relationship. Fear of the Lord is attached to friendship. And as this friendship is nurtured, we become more confident in our anchor point, the thing that is holding us, guiding us, sustaining us throughout life. This nurturing of these two women, of this friendship among them, it gave them courage to act in the face of evil. Because what doesn't control them, is lesser fears. The lesser fears of life. What does control them? The fear of God. Oswald Chambers puts it this way: the remarkable thing about God is that when you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas when you do not fear the Lord, you fear everything else. Listen to one more writer in the describing of this. He says, the fear of the Lord has more to do with attention and imagination than it does with trembling. It's about inhabiting the story. Most of the spiritual life is about paying attention to God and participating with Him. Paying attention to what God is doing and how God is doing what He's doing. The spiritual life is then to inhabit the story God is telling while living in the real world. While living our actual life, there's always competing stories. And the challenge and invitation of the Christian journey is to trust God's story as reality. It's to trust God's story as the realest story. So I invite you to close your Bibles, and I want us to sit just a moment with this question. I hope it's a question that you'll sit with throughout this afternoon. I hope it's a question that you will sit with this week. And you'll allow the Lord to meet you exactly where you are with this question. Can you trust His heart with your story? That's the question. Am I trusting the author? Am I trusting His heart, His intent, His purposes with my story? In fact, I want to encourage you to close your eyes for a moment, and just to try to remove some distraction, I'm going to invite the team up, and they're going to lead us in one more song, and we'll have the opportunity to respond to this as the Lord leads us. But I want you to actually, honestly, in His presence right now, not miss the moment. Can you trust His heart with your story? Do you know how the Creator God brings about rescue, restoration, and redemption? He partners with a delivering ally. That's the definition of Azer. The women that He is partnering with are delivering allies. What does that mean for us? Well, God partners with normal people who walk in the fear of the Lord, who entrust their ordinary lives back to Him through selfless, quiet, subtle acts of resistance against the schemes of the enemy and the pull of the culture. This is how God brings life and freedom. Not just to us, but to many. Trust His heart with your story. If you know the author, then you know this: your life is not random. Every moment, every circumstance, every season is layered with meaning and purpose. If the author becomes friend, we can learn to trust Him even when we cannot trace His hand. Brothers and sisters, the invitation of Exodus is to trust your story, your life, all of it, to the author. How do you do that? It begins by fear of the Lord. Would you stand with me? We're going to sing one more song together, and we'll be commissioned out of here with a benediction. But don't miss the opportunity of the moment to be sensitive to the Spirit. If God's speaking to you, then maybe you don't need to sing along. Maybe you just need to sit in the quiet of this space and keep talking to Him. Maybe you want to move around and pray with someone. Maybe you feel compelled to go pray with someone. Maybe you feel compelled to invite someone to pray with you. There's freedom in this room amongst God's people to be sensitive to the Spirit. Yeah? Can you trust His heart with your story?
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.